King Herod earned the nickname the Great because of all of the building projects and community assistance program he did during the peak of his time on the throne. We're talking about the 20s and the teens of the first century BC. Now, we know that he took off to assist his friend Agrippa, the number two guy in the Roman Empire, during the years 16, 15, and 14 BC. So he was out of his own country, and he was, I think, expecting things to run smoothly in his absence, but they had not been. Now, you may remember he has recently brought his two princely sons back to Judea from Rome, where they've been growing up and being educated in the palace of Caesar Augustus. These two gentlemen are called Alexander and Aristobulus. In the year 14 BC, which is where we're kind of picking up the story, they were 21 and 17 years of age. So they are pretty much adults in the Jewish society. And the expectation that Herod is working on here is that once he is dead and gone, he's probably hoping still further into the future, these two sons of his, who also share the royal blood of the Hasmonean line from their mother, Princess Mariamne, who is dead, that these two will become the new kings of the Jews. And his name will remain famous for making sure that the kingdom of the Jews was so prosperous and well-prepared to go into the hands of these two sons of his. Well, unfortunately, while he was gone on his trip up by the Black Sea, his sister, Salome, has been engaging in a battle of intrigue with these two princely sons. And so once Herod gets back into town in 14 BC, and just to give you a sense of how old he is, he's about 60 when this happens. His sister Salome complains to him, warns him that these two sons of his are plotting to avenge their mother's death by killing him and then assuming control of the kingdom as the legitimate royal heirs. Well, Herod, who doesn't want to really do anything aggressive toward these two sons of his, because he's got plans for them. They're going to be his heirs. He decides to short-circuit any plot they have by bringing his eldest non-royal son back to court. This is a man named Antipater, who is 32 years of age. He was the son of Herod's first wife, whom he divorced in order to marry Princess Mariamne. This doesn't solve the problem. In fact, it makes matters worse, because the two royal sons of Mariamne feel insulted that their older but non-royal brother is now in the picture. He is there on a daily basis with them in the court of their father Herod. Let's go to another year, 13 BC. Agrippa decides to go to Rome again. And after he's completed his administration of the eastern provinces, and when Herod finds out that Agrippa's heading that direction, Herod personally takes Antipater, his oldest boy, and he also goes to the capital and places him under the care of his friend Agrippa, basically saying, look, I think I want my boy to be in Roman court rather than in Judean court back at Jerusalem because there's problems there. Thinking that maybe the distance of 1,000 miles might settle things down, but it doesn't. Because what happens is Antipater, while at Rome, writes letters to his friends back in Jerusalem, trying to undermine his younger royal siblings, or shall we say half-siblings. And he's also making connections in Rome itself with powerful people. And so the two brothers reciprocate. They start trying to undermine their father's relationship with Antipater. So we've got a lot of family tension going on here. So that brings us to 12 BC. In 12 BC, Josephus gives us kind of a blow-by-blow recounting of how this battle of the brothers is going. At this time, Herod is about 62. Alexander is about 23. Aristobulus is 19. And, of course, Antipater is himself, what is it? He's in his mid-30s now. And so Herod decides to make another trip to Rome. And he takes his two boys with him, Alexander and Aristobulus. And once they arrive, he actually brings them up on charges in front of Augustus Caesar of attempted murder or plotting to murder him. Because that's what he keeps being told by his sister Salome. So here is Herod's, Josephus's account of Herod's attempt to accuse his sons of plotting against him. Quote, "But Caesar, after some delay, said that although the young men were thoroughly innocent of that for which they were calumniated or lied about, yet they had been so far to blame that they had not demeaned themselves toward their father so as to prevent the suspicion which was spread abroad concerning them." Now let me break in and explain. Basically, Caesar acts like the judge in a hearing. And after he hears all the evidence, he says, no, there's no evidence here that they're trying to kill you, Herod. And Herod is about 10 years older than Caesar Augustus. And so he says, but they did not act in a way to keep such suspicions from arising. So they have definitely been to blame for that. They should have acted better. Back to the quote. Quote, "He also exhorted Herod to lay aside all such suspicion and to be reconciled to his sons, for that it would not be just to give any credit to such reports concerning his own children, and that this repentance on both sides might heal those breaches that had appeared between them, and might improve their goodwill to one another, and whereby those on both sides, excusing the rashness of their suspicions, might resolve to bring a greater degree of affection towards each other than they had before." And then after Caesar had given them this admonition, he beckoned to the young men. Now, I'm going to break in again and remind you. These two guys that are in their, you know, one of them's already in his 20s, as one is almost in his 20s. They grew up with Caesar. They grew up in his house, seeing him all the time. He's like their guardian for the time they spent in Rome learning. They are like, he's like a favorite uncle that loves them. So keep that in mind when he's now beckoning to the two of them to come up close to him after he's made his comments. Back to the quote. "When therefore they were disposed to fall down to make intercession to their father, he took them up and embraced them as they were in tears, and took each of them distinctly in his arms, till not one of those that were present, whether freeman or slave, but were deeply affected with what they saw. So there's like hugs and crying going on all around in the royal court of the Roman Empire because Caesar is trying to repair the relationship of the Herodian family here. Back to the quote. Then did they return thanks to Caesar and went away together, and with them went Antipater with a hypocritical pretense that he rejoiced at this reconciliation. Now, let me break in again. Antipater had to act as if he was good with this reconciliation because he didn't want to be under the suspicion that he's part of the problem of trying to stir up hard feelings between dad and the two princely brothers. Back to the quote. In the last days they were with Caesar, Herod made him a present of 300 talents. Now, again, let me break in. 300 talents. Each talent is about 6,000 days' wages. You understand that Herod just handed, as a special thank you to Emperor Augustus, he just handed him half of $1 billion, just as a gift. Thank you. That's how rich Herod is. And then he was exhibiting shows and largesses to the people of Rome. So he's paying for things to happen, for poetry readings and drama readings and sports things and stuff like that. So he's doing that and also paying for free food for people in Rome. Back to the quote. Caesar made him a present of half the revenue of the copper mines in Cyprus and committed the care of the other half to him and honored him with other gifts and incomes. And as to his own kingdom, he left it in his power to appoint which of his sons he pleased for his successor and to distribute it in parts to everyone, if he wished to do so, that the dignity might thereby come to them all. And when Herod was disposed to make such a settlement immediately, Herod said he would not give him leave to deprive himself while he was alive of the power over his kingdom or over his sons. Okay, so now this is what's happening is they're kind of saying their goodbyes. So they're all having these big parties together, and Herod is throwing money around all over the place as usual. And then Caesar Augustus says, all right, Herod, my friend, I'm going to give you permission as the emperor. You do whatever you want with your kingdom. But this is what I'd recommend to you. I think you ought to divide it up amongst all of your boys. Give them all bits and pieces of your kingdom, because you've got a big kingdom. And then Herod turns around and says, okay, I'll do that right now. I'll just divide it up and I'll quit being king and they can all have their own little bits and pieces. And Augustus responds by saying, no, that's not what I'm saying. You keep your kingdom, but once you are gone from the scene, once you pass away, whatever you want, that's what's going to happen. And so this should give you some sense of this intimate relationship that existed between Herod and the emperor of the known world. More of the quote from Antiquities, book 16, chapter number 4. From then on, Herod came to Judea and to the temple, where he made a speech to the people concerning what had been done on this his journey. And he also discoursed to them about Caesar's kindness to him, and about as many of the particulars he had done as it, though it were his advantage other people should be acquainted with. So he basically is a trip report to the people of Judea, Jerusalem, about how great things went. And then at last he turned his speech to the admonition of his sons, and exhorted those that lived at court and the multitude to concord, that is, to peacefulness, and informed them that his sons were to reign after him. So now he lets the public know, these are my post-death wishes. This is how I want it to happen. And here's the rest of the quote. Antipater first, and then Alexander and Aristobulus, the sons of Mariamne. But he desired that at present they should all have regard to himself and esteem him king and lord of all, since he was not yet hindered by old age. Now, break in. He's 62, and he is still physically fit. He is still in good health at this point. That is going to change dramatically in the years that are to come, because this is 12 BC. So we're right on the cusp of the gospel stories here. And we know that the Herod we meet there is a crazy, sick old man. Well, he's not there yet. Okay, back to the quote. Since he was not yet hindered by old age, but was in that period of life when he was must be the most skillful in governing, and that he was not deficient in other arts of management that might enable him to govern the kingdom well and to rule over his children well, he further told the rulers under him and the soldiery that in case that they would look upon him alone, their life would be led in peaceable manner, and they would make one another happy. And when he had said this, he dismissed the assembly. So his report basically ends, look, here's my plan. When I'm dead, Antipater will rule until he's dead. And once he's dead, the two princes will then rule, because they're the royal line of the Asmoneans, the priest kings of the Jewish people. So that's his plan. But he says, but right now, I'm still healthy, I'm still fit, I can still think and govern well, so I'm going to keep the job. And if you guys will just back me up in this, everybody can be happy. Everybody can live in peace and prosperity. And certainly, at this stage of the game, that would have been true if people didn't keep working against him. Back to the finishing of the quote. Quote, which speech was acceptable to the greatest part of the audience, but not so to them all. For the contention among his sons and the hopes he had given them occasioned thoughts and desires of innovations among them. Excuse me. Now, at this point, we've only been talking about three of his sons. His eldest boy, Antipater, who is in his 30s and who's not of royal blood. And then the two brothers, Alexander and Aristobulus, who are sons of Princess Mariamne. They are of the royal Hasmonean blood. But he has other sons by other wives that he's had over the years. Those sons are all in their teens. And those sons, when they grow up, several of them will be key players in the story of the gospel and in the story of the book of Acts. So we will develop the understanding of how there is this rivalry between all of these boys as to which of them gets to be in charge after dad is dead. And he's getting up there in age, so they're anticipating it won't be too much longer. All right. Now, we've been talking about things happening in 12 BC. One other thing happened, and that was the 10-year construction of Caesarea on the coast. This is Caesarea Sebaste, the great big harbor city that he started back in the 20s. All that was finished and dedicated. And it became a major event in the Roman Empire. And it highlights once again just how prominent King Herod was all over the known world. And so here's a quote from Josephus from Antiquities, Book 16, Chapter Number 5 on this event. Quote, there was accordingly a great festival and most sumptuous preparations made presently in order to its dedication. For he had appointed a contention or a contest in music and games to be performed naked. And he had also gotten ready a great number of those that fight single combats and of beasts for the like purpose, horse races also, and the most chargeable of such sports and shows as used to be exhibited at Rome and in other places. Okay, break into the quotation here. So he basically throws a great big dedication bash for his brand new harbor city. It's one of the greatest harbors, man-made harbors, in the Mediterranean. You can go there now, and in October of 23, Lord willing, I'm going to be going and I'm going to be taking a group. I hope maybe some of you will come with us. You will see the remains of some of these very places that he was holding these special games and contests to celebrate the completion of this harbor town. Okay, back to the quote. He consecrated this combat to Caesar, and ordered it to be celebrated every fifth year. So break into the quote. Not only are they going to celebrate here in the 12 BC, but 5 years from now, they'll have another celebration. And then 5 years after that, another celebration. Because in Augustus's rule and reign, every 5 years of his reign, there's a special celebration. And Herod is, he's big time into that. He's got Augustus games that happen every 5 years in Jerusalem. Now he's got Augustus games that are going on in his great big port of Caesarea as well. Back to the quote. He also sent out all sorts of ornaments for it out of his own furniture, that it might have nothing to make it, that it might want nothing to make it decent. Indeed, Julia, Caesar's wife, sent a great part of her most valuable furniture from Rome, inasmuch as he had no want of anything. And the sum of them all was an estimate of 500 talents. Now, each talent is 6,000 days' wages, so you're talking about millions, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of material, including furniture from the palace at Rome is brought to Caesarea and put on display so that everybody can kind of see the magnificence of the empire and of Herod's kingdom. And so this is just more of proof that Judea was the showpiece of the Roman Republic at this time between the 1st century BC into the 1st century AD. Let's go back and finish the quote. Now, when a great multitude was come to that city to see the shows, as well as the ambassadors whom other people sent on account of the benefits they had received from Herod, he entertained them all in the public inns and at public tables and with perpetual feasts. This solemnity, having in the daytime the diversions of the fights and in the nighttime such merry meetings at cost as cost vast sums of money, and publicly demonstrated the generosity of his soul. Did you catch all that? He's footing the bill for free feasts during the dedication ceremonies, many days long. He's paying for all of the public shows. He's paying for all of the public contests and the awards ceremonies. He's paying for all of that because this guy is filthy, filthy rich. He's not just simply a billionaire. He's probably a trillionaire. Back to the quote. For in all his undertakings, he was ambitious to exhibit what exceeded whatsoever had been done before of the same kind. And it related that Caesar and Agrippa often said, now that's Caesar Augustus and Agrippa, the number two guy to Caesar the emperor. These two guys often said that the dominion of Herod was too little for the greatness of his soul. For what he deserved was to have both all the kingdom of Syria and that of Egypt also. So did you catch that? The two top guys said that he basically deserved to be the number three guy in the kingdom, to basically be in charge of the entire eastern end of the Roman Mediterranean Empire. Now, Herod's generosity that they've just complimented, it's world renowned at this time. He even saved the Olympic Games that had almost gone out around this time. More of the quote from Josephus' Antiquities. But as for his other benefits, it's impossible to reckon them up. Those which he bestowed on the cities both in Syria and then in Greece and in all the places that he came in his voyages, for he seems to have conferred, and that after a most plentiful manner, what would minister to many necessities and the buildings of public works, and gave them the money that was necessary for such works as wanted it, to support them upon the failure of their other revenues. But what was the greatest and most illustrious of all his works? He erected Apollo's temple at Rhodes at his own expense and gave them a great number of talents of silver for the repair of their fleet. Break into the quote. Basically, everywhere that he traveled, and he traveled a lot apparently, If he saw somebody that needed assistance rebuilding buildings or rebuilding fleets, he would just pay for it because he had that much money. And that made him a popular person the world over. Here's more of the quote. He also built the greatest part of the public edifices for the inhabitants of Nicopolis at Actium, and for the Antiochians, the inhabitants of the principal city of Syria, where a broad street cuts through the place lengthwise. He built cloisters along it on both sides and laid the open road with polished stone, which was a very great advantage to the inhabitants. So he basically built Main Street in Antioch, Syria. And it wasn't just the street itself that he had paved with polished stones. He had covered walkways on both sides the full length. That's how much money he has. And then this. As to the Olympic Games, probably the Olympic Games that were scheduled for 8 BC, because we're in 12 BC right now. They've already happened. So this is probably for the upcoming Games, which would have been happening in Greece. As for the Olympic Games, which were in a very low condition by reason of the failure of the revenues, he recovered their reputation and appointed revenues for their maintenance and made that solemn meeting more venerable. And as to the sacrifices and other ornaments, and by reason of this vast liberality, he was generally declared in their inscriptions to be one of the perpetual managers of those games. So he saved the Olympian Games right around 8 BC to make sure that they continued on for many more cycles by footing the bill for them and making sure that there was money for all the awards contest, all the awards given for the contests and the venues there in Greece that needed to be rebuilt. So I don't know how much money he had, but it was more than sufficient for him to accomplish all these things. And it's another reason why he is referred to as Herod the Great. Come back tomorrow, and let's talk about how he then became part of the story of the gospel.